Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You is Christopher Durang's best known and most controversial play. This comedy about an authoritarian nun was picketed in several cities by offended Catholics. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich once described Durang as a master at framing metaphysical conundrums in the terms of pop culture kitsch. Sister Mary is included in a new edition of Durang's plays called Christopher Durang Explains It All for You. It contains five other plays, including Beyond Therapy, which Robert Altman adapted into a film. Christopher Durang's last play, Laughing Wild, flopped, but he had more success in 1989 with his comedy cabaret act Chris Durang and Dawn. The comic premise was that he had given up playwriting and was now touring Ramada Inns.
I came out singing bad, and then we segued into Bally High, and my backup group had very corny hand motions and things. And then in describing who I was, I would say I'm Chris Durang, and I used to be a playwright, but it was too hard. I'm hoping this is easier. Dawn and I have been traveling around to Ramada Inns. It's been horrible. Things like, and saying that playwriting was too hard. A lot of people assumed that I was telling the truth about the Ramada Inns, but in truth, we haven't been traveling to Ramada Inns, but I suppose we could have been.
But I bet you were telling the truth about playwriting,
I'm kidding about giving up playwriting, but on the other hand, there was a kernel of truth in that I just was feeling a little discouraged by writing for New York theater, and that in a certain sense it seemed easier to become a cabaret singer.
What was discouraging about New York theater? What still is discouraging about it?
It's a topic that I actually bore myself with a little bit, which is that it's just the New York Times is very powerful, and so if you're not liked by their critics or their main critic, but actually anybody who writes for them, it's just hard to get an audience or hard to get a show to run, and. On one hand, I've been successful with my plays, but looked at a different way. It's only been Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You that was critically acclaimed and then ran for a couple of years. So I've just felt a little discouraged by cumulatively the plays of mine that have not been embraced critically. So it just, and I know I suppose I shouldn't care about it, but it becomes hard not to, at least for me.
There seems something almost masochistic for you to be a playwright. And one of the things is, you know, you loved Broadway. I know you grew up loving movies. But you've chosen for yourself a form of writing that far fewer people see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's...
Well, it is frustrating that it's a small audience. I think I was realizing recently, you know, the Broadway that I grew up with in the late 50s and early 60s... in a way, doesn't exist anymore. It's shrunk. There are far fewer plays,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the ones that succeed are kind of the musical spectacles, some of which I like. For instance, I actually liked Les Miserables, but other ones are, they're not what I aspire to. I don't hope to write one. I don't hope to meet up with Andrew Lloyd Webber and write Dogs or something. And so I think... you know, I hoped that I would write a comedy play that succeeded on Broadway, and with Beyond Therapy, I feel I came close. I haven't actually had a Broadway play since then. That was 1982. So you're right, and sometimes I'll go to a Broadway play that is successful and running, and I'll kind of look and see the what seems like a limited social class that you're writing to and for, and the prices are so expensive that, in a certain sense, I am realizing that maybe it's masochistic or not thrilling to be writing for that audience. So I've also written screenplays that have unfortunately not been made, been paid for, but haven't been made. And I've taken a job a few months ago to write a sitcom for the Fox Network, which is the first time I've tried that. And one of the things that interests me, aside from being well paid, is that the audience is very broad. I mean, I know theater people traditionally perhaps look down on television, but I'm going through a legitimate period of not looking down on it and being interested by the fact that you can reach such a large audience.
What's the premise of the sitcom?
The premise, I'm calling the show Dysfunction the TV Show. And it's, you know, the whole phrase dysfunction and dysfunctional families is, which I think is interesting and truthful, is on the other hand on every single talk show all the time.
So that's
it's
right,
on the brink of becoming a cliche. And so my show is about a dysfunctional family and two family therapists who are working with them and filming them at home and interviewing them and having them in family group therapies. And, of course, I do mean it to be a comedy. So I've just actually handed in my first draft, and on this, in a couple of days I'll be talking to them to see what their feedback is. So, gee, I hope they like it, and I hope that we get on the air at some point. But anyway, that's what the show is about.
Your best-known play is Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You. Mm-hmm. And in just about every city you played in, there were attempts by Catholics to close the play down. Mm-hmm. Were you flattered by the attention?
I always felt that it was a very, conservative group of Catholics and sometimes non-Catholics who were offended by the play. I wasn't expecting them to be offended. I thought that they would just say, oh, well, I don't agree. So I was... not flattered, I was surprised. And I guess I might have been flattered. The only reason I wasn't is that I took, since in a couple of cities, notably St. Louis, there were attempts to change the Missouri State Art Council funding laws. It was kind of a dry run for what happened in with the National Endowment and Jesse Helms this past year. The topic, however, not being sexual content, but being religious content and religious criticism. But whenever people want to change laws because of something that's been written, I'm not flattered. I'm alarmed.
Sister Mary Ignatius is one of the plays included in your book. Can I get you to do a short reading from it?
Sure.
I think it's legitimate to ask you because you've acted as well as written.
yes, I have sometimes. The first part of Sister Mary Ignatius is a lecture in which she's describing, explaining it all for you, meaning how the entire world works in her opinion. And she gets to a part where she's taking questions. Here's one of her questions she takes. She's reading... The question is, what exactly went on in Sodom? Sister's irritated. Who asked me this question? She then goes on to answer something else but comes back to it. I'm going to talk about Sodom for a bit. To answer your question, Sodom is where they committed acts of homosexuality and bestiality in the Old Testament, and God, infuriated by this, destroyed them all in one fell swoop. Modern-day Sodoms are New York City, San Francisco, Amsterdam, Los Angeles, well, basically anywhere where the population is over 50,000. The only reason that God has not destroyed these modern-day Sodoms is that Catholic nuns and priests live in these cities, and God does not wish to destroy them. He does, however, give these people body lice and hepatitis. It's so hard to know why God allows wickedness to flourish. I guess it's because God wants man to choose goodness freely of his own free will. Sometimes one wonders if free will is worth all the trouble, if there's going to be so much evil and unhappiness, but God knows best, presumably. If it were up to me, I might be tempted to wipe out cities and civilizations, but luckily for New York and Amsterdam, I'm not God.
A lot of kids who go to Catholic school, no matter how they end up feeling years later, while they're in Catholic school, want to become a nun or a priest.
Yes,
those are like the role models they have around them. Did you go through a period like that yourself?
Yes, I did. Particularly in the 50s and 60s, being a nun or a priest was a bit pitched to you as a child. It was sort of, it was kind of like if you're really, really lucky, you'll discover that God has chosen you for this special life. So, children who want to please do go through periods of thinking, gee, wouldn't this be wonderful if I have this special calling? And then then the other place where I sort of thought of being a priest is that in high school is one place where some children stop believing. That did not happen to me. I became more believing in high school and more religious. And also I really liked and still do like the priests who taught me, these Benedictine priests. And the school was on the grounds of a monastery, and the life of the monastery seemed terribly peaceful and serene and centered, because one thing that's appealing about the religious life is that if you do believe in God, these are people who have decided that their belief in God is the most important thing in life, and it's not to succeed on Broadway, and it's not to make a lot of money. It's to live for your central belief. So there is something very attractive about that. And so when I was in high school, I found that very appealing, and there was a part of me that thought that living that life would be very satisfying.
How did you lose your faith?
Well, one day I just misplaced it. I looked under the bed. And, well, you know, I will answer the question, but I feel slightly self-conscious because it's very common. It happens to lots of people, and it's also very young man-ish. It had to do with the belief that God was watching over us and somehow was involved with man's history. And it both had to do with things like family upset on the one hand. So you would see family upset and you had been taught to pray for it, but you sort of thought, well, is God up in heaven listening to these prayers and saying, no, I have some special reason, I'm going to let it go on. Then the other thing was that when I was in college is when the Vietnam War was happening and the protests were happening, and I was actually part of the liberal group of Catholics who were very opposed to the war. And we would also pray for the end of the war. And, you know, if you focused on the suffering of the, you know, you'd watch the napalm children on television and you would pray that God would stop this war. And then when the war wouldn't stop, you would sort of got confused what prayer was for. And if God was really involved, you know, does God sit up there I make a joke in my newest play, Laughing Wild, which is, you know, that when I would watch people on the Tony Awards thank God for helping them win the Tony Awards, I had to ask myself, well, is God silent on the Holocaust, but he involves himself in the Tony Awards? So that's the issue that made me suddenly just feel that what I'd been taught, that God was up there involved in our daily history, wasn't true. But that's kind of what made me stop believing.
Do you still feel that you miss having faith, that you'd like to have
yes,
faith if
absolutely.
Only you could?
And I've also, you know, it's such a terrible cliche that as we get older, we do mellow and all these things. The word spiritual used to be meaningless to me. And now I don't quite know what it means, but I have this little buzz of positive feeling about whatever spiritual is. I don't know what, but I'm starting to have the flickerings of belief in something, but I'd be hard-pressed to say what it was.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Christopher Durang, Explains It All for You, is published by Grove Weidenfeld. This is Fresh Air.